Good morning, everyone. I think we'll get started because we have a limited amount of time and we have a great panel up here. I'm Jill Wexler. I cover FDA and a lot of its related activities, working for Trade Press here in Washington. The panel title is listed as FDA Under Pressure, but in looking at my notes for the last few weeks, I decided it really should be called FDA Under Attack. And I thought I was all set in making some opening remarks. I mean, we have the example of numerous crises, contaminated heparin, food recalls, one crisis after another. But yesterday I looked at my emails when I got back in the evening and I found three new warnings from FDA. It turns out that they're investigating an asthma drug which may cause suicidality, which just came out yesterday. There seem to be cardio risks from several prominent AIDS drugs and a foot gel used by diabetics that may cause cancer and death. And there was a recall yesterday of a total body health drink that evidently makes all your hair fall out. So,
but you have better muscles.
Oh, better muscles, okay. I saw a story just a few days ago I picked up on the web, headline FDA's Biggest Blunders. It listed an FDA Hall of Shame of drugs with serious side effects that FDA failed to catch before they were approved. You're probably all familiar, Vioxx, Bextra, Zelnorm, Tysabri. Just take your pick on what seems to be the latest crisis with this agency. And if the story is not about unsafe drugs, it's about how FDA has hit all-time lows in approving new drugs for market. Cancer advocates are up in arms. I was at another meeting last week about what they see as a slowdown in FDA approvals and stiffer testing requirements for bringing new life-saving treatments to market. So what's going on here? Is FDA getting a bum rap? Is the system broke for detecting what's really safe and effective in new medical products and treatments? I was at a meeting yesterday for food and drug lawyers and regulatory experts where Carl Peck, who was the director of FDA's Drug Center back in the 90s, described it a guerrilla environment at FDA. That's with the French spelling. Created, he said, by ambitious politicians looking to make headlines, opportunistic academics, and media competing for front page space. Clearly, there's been a loss of trust in FDA, and that's bad news, I think, for everybody involved with medical practice and medical research. Doctors want to have confidence in the medicines they prescribe, and they're appearing very confused. Researchers in academia and in industry see drug development programs being killed each year after they've been spending years and millions of dollars on investing in them. Companies really don't want to spend $1 billion developing a new drug if they have to pull it off the market in a few months. And what about generic drugs, which are considered a potential way to save a lot of money in healthcare spending, but the whole industry relies on FDA to determine that these products are just as safe and effective as the original drug with less costly testing. If you can't rely on FDA to make these determinations, what happens to them? Some changes are underway already due to legislation that was enacted last September. Drug companies now face stiffer penalties if they don't post results of clinical trials or complete promise post-approval studies, something that there's been a lot of complaints about. FDA can require labeling changes when safety issues emerge instead of having to negotiate revisions with manufacturers. There's more money to approve adverse event reporting systems and to expand FDA staffs to oversee imports and drug safety issues. Congress is weighing stronger food safety legislation, and there's other ideas floating around. But these are not going to be issues to resolve. We have a great panel to help us, and I've asked the panel members just to speak 5-7 minutes. And hopefully leave a lot of time open for questions. Our first speaker is Gail Cassell, who's prominent in the pharmaceutical industry and FDA circles. She oversees global philanthropic programs related to infectious diseases for Eli Lilly, and she served on prominent advisory boards all over the health establishment, National Institutes of Health, Centers for Disease Control and Protection, Institute of Medicine. She's here probably because most recently she's now on FDA Science Board and chaired the subcommittee that produced a report on how the lack of funding and resources has depleted FDA's scientific base and risks eroding its stature as the gold standard for food and drug regulation. Gail and many of her colleagues, and there's a summary of it in the back of the room along with another handout if you didn't pick it up, they're using this report to lobby Congress for a big boost in FDA's budget. And she'll describe this report and maybe help us answer, is increased funding for FDA enough? What should FDA do with that money? And what should FDA do to regain public trust? Gail.
Thank you. I thank you, Jill, for giving me the opportunity to say a few words this morning to a group of very important people who have a very loud voice and I think hopefully will appreciate what I'm about to say. I'm deviating from the presentation that I had prepared where I was going to give you a lot of specifics concerning our report to share with you what I consider to be the most important messages that I would hope you would take away. And the first is that this was a report of the FDA Science Board. We were a subcommittee of the Science Board. There were three members of the Science Board on the subcommittee. I chaired it. There were 30 external experts, over half those being members of the National Academy of Sciences and one Nobel laureate. It was a committee composed of individuals from the public sector, from academic institutions, from other governmental agencies, and from industry with very in-depth knowledge of the agency, including former assistant secretaries of health, the former chief legal counsel for FDA, former FDA employees, CDC employees, NIH employees, a former CEO of Merck. And so the point I'm trying to make is this was a committee of very busy people, very knowledgeable people, but people who care a lot about the agency, people who believe very strongly that a time when our economic well-being is being threatened, our security is being threatened, and furthermore, human lives being threatened by not having the very strongest regulatory agency that we can have during these troubled times, we felt very strongly about what we were doing. You should also be aware that our report has been called a scathing report. We certainly didn't feel that it was a scathing report. However, we believed that it was important to say what we thought and to call it like it was. It was a committee, actually, subcommittee, appointed by the FDA commissioner. He asked the Science Board to appoint a committee. The Science Board appointed the committee to identify the science and technology gaps within the agency as the agency currently performs its responsibilities. In fact, are there gaps that would preclude their being able to fulfill their mission? And, by the way, not just today, but over the next decade. We were not asked to comment on resources. If anything, we were discouraged about doing that, but to focus rather on what the gaps actually were. At the end of a year's time, after having spent many hours, weekends, holidays, we issued a report to the FDA Science Board, the full Science Board, on December 3rd. This report was unanimously accepted and also unanimously submitted. There was absolutely no disagreement about the conclusions nor the recommendations, perhaps maybe about what we felt should happen in the way of the amount of funding and when that funding should be implemented, but there was great consensus in terms of what we were trying to say. Great consensus that the report should be very broadly communicated to the public and to policymakers. Jill, would take some offense at what you said about lobbying Congress. That was certainly not our intent, nor have we been trying to do that. I will say we've been trying to work with Congress to address what we consider some very serious issues. And along with that, participated in a hearing that was a five-hour hearing, a very long hearing, on January the 29th. We were subsequently asked if we would provide very detailed recommendations in terms of what our committee thought would be required in the way of resources to implement our recommendations, and so we did respond to that request. The broad conclusion of the report is that science at FDA is in a precarious state with deficiencies in specific areas, particularly of the new and emerging sciences, as we would call it, including genomics, nanotechnologies, and others, areas, imaging, areas in which we feel are the up-and-coming, but certainly are already there in terms of the new and exciting therapies and vaccines that can be brought to bear on the public health challenges that we face. We issued this report with and worked hard on the report with the utmost respect for the staff of FDA. In fact, as you work trying to do this report, you realize just how stretched they really are to meet the needs of the public, working long hours, also weekends. So first and foremost, in fact, you have to appreciate that this committee, in fact, developed even a deeper respect for the staff and would make the argument it's because of the dedicated staff that we have not had more disasters than we have today. It's because of them that we've been able to avert those. So that is a message that I would like to make very strong and very clear. I think that in view of our report, but also other public criticism of the agency that occurs almost on a daily basis, as Jill has said, has resulted in a decrease in morale and, in fact, in probably the inability to recruit the best and then also loss of some of the best scientific talent. I would just share with you that during the year when we were doing this report, that two of the center directors left FDA, and we found out that there had been four chief information officers over a period of 5 years, that the turnover rate in FDA personnel, scientific personnel, is twice that of other comparable scientific-based agencies like CDC and NIH. And we all need to appreciate this and to do everything we can to preclude this drain, if you will, of talent in the future. So the other thing that I wanted to just point out is that we can, in the discussion, go into very much detail as far as the scientific areas in which we identified gaps. But what I wanted to do is to talk a little bit, because Jill had asked me to, if you had increased resources, what would you consider the highest priorities? In fact, we did think a lot about this as we did our work and then in response to the questions from Congress. We all appreciate that there needs to be a significant increase in funding. It can't be a small amount. It can't be dribbled out. But we also realize that, in fact, the increases need to be very thoughtful and targeted to those areas in greatest need. And, in fact, that it needs to be sustained. It cannot be a one-time or a flattening of the budget after that increase. This would also not accomplish the goal. You might think of FDA as being somewhat like a rainforest. It can be destroyed within days, in fact, hours in some cases, but it takes years to build up, and that's because the base of FDA is the very science upon which this agency is based, and every day the decisions that are made in regulation of over $1 trillion worth of products and 25 cents of every dollar that we all spend needs to be based on the very best scientific evidence that is available in order to ensure the public's health and safety and well-being and our economic well-being as well. So we recommended an increase in 2008 of $375 million over the currently recommended appropriations for 2008, and by 2013 that the total appropriated funds be $3.7 billion. And we feel very strongly about these amounts. We did have people, we believe, on this committee that are very familiar with developing budgets to do exactly what we were recommending be done in a lot of the areas. Where should those monies be spent? First and foremost, in every area in which we looked, it was apparent that the IT, the information technology infrastructure at the agency, is obsolete. It's outdated. Over 80% of the computers have long exceeded their lives. In fact, you may have seen a quote from Dr. Woodcock last week in which she herself said that the computers that were put in place to monitor adverse event reporting, a very complex and sophisticated data mining exercise, was put in place, hobbled together over a decade ago with only $30,000. I think we all can appreciate just how threadbare that system must be and how much it needs to be repaired, particularly with all the emphasis on the need for increased monitoring, not only of food safety, but also drug safety as well. After the IT infrastructure, which is absolutely critical to everything the agency does, and especially for monitoring manufacturing sites, but also food safety, I just point out that we uncovered that during one of the E. coli 157 outbreaks, one of the largest, the email system went down, so there was inability to communicate, which caused problems. But in addition then to the IT, people and also hardware that are needed, food safety is of utmost importance, particularly in terms of the number of inspectors needed. And we certainly feel that both CIFSAN, the Center for Food Science and Nutrition, as well as the Center for Veterinary Medicine that have bearing on food safety, is in great need of strengthening. They are down by 1,000 personnel compared to what they had, and overall FDA is down or at the same level of personnel that they had 15 years ago. This is in the face of having now the responsibility of regulating over 300,000 sites outside of this country in 100 different countries. And don't forget, the total of the products regulated is $1 trillion a year. However, the budget, a total appropriated budget of FDA, is only a little over $1.5 billion. I don't think we have to think too hard to realize this is totally inadequate. So I think that I'll stop there, Jill, and wait to have further discussions as we hear from Michael and Susan.
Well, I think that's a great segue into Mike's comments. Mike Taylor, in the middle of our panel, is at George Washington University and a recognized expert on food safety and public health. He has the background for this. He was a top official at FDA during when David Kessler was commissioner, and he subsequently went to the Department of Agriculture, where he headed the Food Safety and Inspection Service. He's also involved with an assessment of nanotechnology on food and medical product development, if people are interested in that. Mike, can FDA ever get enough resources to ensure the safety of everything from California spinach to Chinese peanut butter? Gail mentioned all these thousands of sites. Is it possible to have inspectors overseeing them? Is the administration's food protection plan, which they've made a big fuss about, is that going to be any help? And what about proposed legislation circulating on Capitol Hill?
Thanks, Jill. And I appreciate a chance to be here with Susan and Gail and with you. I think it's a really good thing that food safety is on the agenda of a meeting of healthcare journalists. I work at a school of public health, and I naturally think of food safety and the prevention of foodborne illness being an integral part of the health system, the prevention side of the health system. And I think, again, it's appropriate that food safety be represented here. I have a feeling that the reason food safety is on the agenda this year, though, is that because of what we're reading in the papers. And this is, without doubt, an incredibly dynamic time for food safety in our country and really globally. And it's all a function, I believe, of change that we're seeing in the food system and consequently in the nature of the foodborne hazards that we face and the foodborne illnesses that result, and it's change driven by technology. The outbreaks associated with leafy green vegetables, produce. We didn't have bagged lettuce 15 years ago to any significant degree. It's a wonderful, innovative product. It meets a need. It's got positive health consequences. It also creates a whole different potential hazard in terms of foodborne illness, and obviously globalization. I mean, 15 years ago, we weren't getting a huge share of our seafood from China. We now are, with all the issues that raises with respect to use of antibiotics and other chemicals and other issues related to the safety of imported foods. And again, it's not just China. It's a global phenomenon, as Gail points out. So I think the main point I want to make today is that is all of that change and all those new challenges really has revealed a food safety program at FDA that is in trouble. It's more than under pressure. It's in real trouble, in my view. And I will say that I, you know, basically believe that it's in trouble in part because of the change in the outside world, but also because of a pattern of neglect of the food program at FDA and of FDA as an institution that needs certain capabilities to be able to deal effectively with the problem of foodborne illness. I want to emphasize that I speak as a fan and loyalist of FDA. I worked there a couple of times. My wife had her career there. And I have a lot of good friends here, and I work closely with people at FDA today on food safety, and I know the quality and the seriousness of the effort that's going into food safety among the people working in the professional ranks at FDA. I think society has really treated that institution very badly with respect to its food safety capabilities, and it's manifested in three things. And I, you know, the three points that I want to make today, and I do have these talking points, a handout in the back of the room, and so I'm going to be very quick in going over these, but sort of three basic messages. One is that in the face of all of these increased challenges, FDA's food safety resources are really in decline in real terms. There's been an actual decline of about 20% in the headquarters staff in the primary Center for Food Safety and Applied Nutrition, Gail mentioned, available for, you know, for food safety. These are the folks who bring the science, bring the standard setting, the priority setting, would drive the initiatives to address today's food safety problems, and rather than having a growing capacity just at that basic level of science staff, they're in absolute decline over the last number of years. With respect to FDA's field force, again, Gail mentioned this, this has been a chronic problem of underfunding, and this is a bipartisan problem, let me just say, where there's never been a recognition of the need to have an adequate inspectional force for food safety. It's really been static or declining. There was a little blip up when the bioterror events happened and some additional resources, but they've been bled down because Congress hasn't provided the resources to even keep up with pay increases. So, you know, budgets remain flat in absolute terms or decline, but actual staffing levels go down. And the President's 2009 budget request, well, I think rightly they can point out that compared to other agencies, FDA didn't do as badly as some, it really barely keeps up with inflation. So we have not begun, despite the good efforts of a lot of people to advocate for more resources, we really haven't begun to solve the problem. So resources are declining as the job grows. The second point, though, that I want to make, this begins to respond to Jill's questions, more resources alone will not solve the problem with the food safety program at FDA. It operates under statutes that are obsolete, and it operates under an organizational structure that really is an obstacle to FDA being able to exert leadership on food safety. And let me just make a couple of points to explain what I mean by obsolete statutes and a really insufficient organizational structure for leadership. The basic laws under which FDA operates in addressing foodborne illness were enacted in 1938, and these are tools that were, you know, obviously a completely different era in terms of the kinds of problems being faced. They were tools that were basically designed to empower FDA to react to problems. If they found a problem with a particular lot of food contaminated, they could take action to remove it from the market. But there was no understanding that we need to be preventive about foodborne illness and giving FDA tools to be systematically preventive about foodborne illness problems. And this is I want to just emphasize the importance of this point because it really gets to where we need to go to fix the system, and that is that we really do need to shift to a system that focuses on preventing foodborne illness. FDA will never have enough inspectors to answer that question, Jill, to monitor and correct problems after the fact and come close to meeting the public expectation for food safety, which is that we're doing everything we reasonably can systematically to prevent problems. And so, sure, they need more resources, and I would say a doubling, you know, over the next 5 years for the food program is a minimum sort of objective, and then that needs to be sustained. But we also need a modernized statutory mandate so that FDA has clear authority and a clear mandate from Congress to hold food companies accountable for preventing food safety problems. It needs to be a whole philosophical shift so that instead of thinking of FDA as a reactive cop on the beat, it's still a cop on the beat, but it's enforcing a defined duty of food companies to put in place the modern preventive process controls to prevent food safety problems. That's a philosophical shift that has to happen. And finally, on the organizational point, you hear a lot about the fragmentation of the federal food safety system, and people talk about FDA, and then they talk about USDA and EPA and CDC, and those are four big actors on the scene which operate independently and struggle at times to integrate their efforts as much as they should, and I think there's a need for fundamental reform at that level. But just within FDA, there are at least three major operating components of the agency that are independent of each other, and that have major responsibilities for food safety. The Center for Food Safety and Applied Nutrition, which Gail mentioned, is ostensibly the lead agency within FDA on food safety. But there is also a second headquarters component that has major food safety responsibilities. That's the Center for Veterinary Medicine. So when melamine in pet food came along, that was a Center for Veterinary Medicine responsibility, not a Center for Food Safety responsibility. The Center for Vet Medicine also deals with animal drug residues and make a lot of significant food safety related decisions. But then the Office of Regulatory Affairs is the part of FDA that manages the field force, the inspection force. And in fact, just in terms of dollars, the majority of the resources at FDA that are labeled food safety resources are managed by the Office of Regulatory Affairs. Well, these agencies, these components within FDA really are independently managed, and they all theoretically report to the commissioner. But the commissioner has many other jobs to do. I mean, a critical point that I think needs to be addressed is that there needs to be within FDA a top official whose full-time responsibility is food safety and who is responsible and has line authority, budget authority, management responsibility, and accountability for the overall food safety program at FDA and who reports to the Secretary of Health and Human Services. We expect FDA to exert national and global leadership on food safety, and we've got an organizational structure within FDA for food safety that is not only fragmented but really buried in the bureaucracy. And unable to access and be able to engage the politically accountable officials who really control the ability of the agency to exert initiatives. And the last thing I'll mention is that sort of goes beyond these institutional issues of resources, statutes, and structure is philosophy. And I don't know whether we want to get into this or not, but we do need to equip this agency with the tools it needs to do its job, but then it has to be allowed to do its job. It has to. We have to, frankly, return to a willingness to regulate in this country. And I think, unfortunately, for a lot of reasons, some of which are good, we've sort of shifted away from the history of command and control regulation and sort of oppressive regulation. But we've come to understand there are different approaches to regulation that empower industry flexibility, that involves setting performance standards and holding companies accountable for getting the good result but not dictating how they do it. Well, we've sort of lost the willingness to even use those modern tools of regulation. An example that I'll use just to close here is that in the wake of the rash of outbreaks of illness associated with leafy greens, the United Fresh Produce Association, an association that represents many of the largest growers and processors of those products, publicly called for FDA to issue enforceable mandatory standards for safe growing and processing of leafy greens. That was over a year ago, as reported in the Wall Street Journal, at least, and we judge of course, I would say we all have our own sources on this, but the Wall Street Journal reports that FDA has gone to the Secretary's office, has asked for the go-ahead to just begin the rulemaking process to consider how these standards might be set, and has been rebuffed in its efforts to do that. And regardless of what the internal process is, and we shouldn't put Susan on the spot to have to sort of go into that, The fact is that almost well over a year after even the industry realizes we need to set enforceable standards, there nothing has been done. And so, again, I think we've got to look after the institution, and then we've got to have a will to use the tools of regulation to be smart, preventive, and achieve the public health goal of reducing foodborne illness.
Well, you definitely have set things up for Susan tonight. Susan Winkler is the chief of staff at FDA and the commissioner's right hand, and she probably knows as much as anyone is what goes on in the agency. She's a pharmacist and a lawyer, and although she's very experienced in Washington politics and policy, she's probably had to develop a thicker skin in the past year than maybe she had in her previous lives. Susan, your boss has been stating publicly in the last week or so that FDA is in peril. I hadn't heard such strong words from him before, that it's overburdened and needs more resources. Why are we hearing this now? Is it too late? What's prompting this? Maybe it's some of the work of the people in this room.
Well, let's say that I think, as the commissioner has stated, we're certainly facing, as he says, peril and promise, and that we are at that point of the agency that we can choose to go in the right direction and continue some trajectory or miss it and face that peril. I think what the commissioner is saying and the agency has recognized is that we are in a different world and facing a different environment that requires a different approach. And by saying different, I don't mean a complete reversal or change in direction of what we have been doing, but perhaps an acceleration in some areas. It is very different. I greatly appreciate Mike's comments about the need to focus on prevention, because indeed, if there's one word that I hear multiple times a day at the agency, it's about prevention and how do we implement prevention, intervention, and response, and think about, even when we're dealing with an outbreak of a foodborne illness, what do we need to do today to address the concern with Salmonella Litchfield in cantaloupes from Honduras, but what can we also do tomorrow to help improve the system there so that we prevent those problems in the future? Now, some may argue that's not really prevention, it's just doing a full response, but I'd say it's different from previous approaches where, because of the firefighting role that the agency plays, we've spent a lot of time putting out those fires and moving to the next fire rather than saying, what fire safety prevention can we put into place? So let me talk about just a few things, and then I really am very interested in the dialogue and the give and take, and greatly appreciate the opportunity to be here today with Gail and Mike to talk about what I think. Obviously, I'm biased and have a conflict of interest I should disclose. I think highly of the FDA because I work there and know that we face challenges and want to improve. Jill, you opened by saying that we're under assault, and I'd say, as we approach things, we're certainly under a lot of scrutiny, but much of that is because what we do matters, and much of that is in the press because we need to work with the press to help explain what's happening in a foodborne outbreak, in a safety signal, or explain why a certain drug or medical product isn't approved, or why there's been a change in our policy in approaching cosmetics or something else. That we chose to put out that early communication on those three safety signals because we want the public to know through you that we're looking at it. We don't have an answer, but we want you to know about it. Some see these safety communications and even recalls as failures of the agency, that if we get to that point, then we have failed in our mission. I'd argue that it's more the success of the life cycle approach, that decades ago we wouldn't have been able to see, or we simply did not see, adverse effects from medical products because we weren't gathering that information and evaluating it. So we couldn't say there may be a signal of an increase in cancer or suicidality with a certain product. We may not have connected 50 illnesses in 16 states all connected to one type of salmonella, because remember, there was a time when we didn't all carry BlackBerries and have instant communication, but rather relied on something a little more dated as a fax machine, and even before that, other communication mechanisms that were not as available. So we can do more, intervene more often, and respond, but that means that we're talking about some of these safety issues more frequently. Now, do we face challenges? Absolutely. Gail mentioned one, and that's recruiting. We are in a hiring surge. We are looking for people to work at the FDA, and we are finding good people and bringing them in. But it's fair to say one of the challenges we face is that a fair number of people will say to me, "What's it like to work there? You get beaten up all the time. Are you sure you have all this congressional oversight? People say bad things about you." I think it's also helping candidates understand that you can come and make a difference, and that it really is a place where you are talking about the future in medical products, talking about existing medications that change lives, medical products that change lives, as well as talking about and doing something to make sure that the waffles and strawberries that my daughter ate for breakfast this morning are okay, and that I can send her to her preschool and she'll be all right, and I'm not going to think twice about what she eats at preschool either, because I know there are folks who are working on those issues. So we do face those challenges. We do also, I think, face the challenge that many in the public don't realize there are actual human beings that work at the FDA, and that we have a commitment and an understanding, and that those public servants are really trying to do the right thing. Do we make mistakes? Oh, yes, we do. But we try to learn from them and move on. Imports is another challenge that we face. The globalization has simply changed what it is that this agency does, that we have parts and pieces of medical products, a significant portion of the food supply coming from outside the United States. What does that mean for our regulatory structure, and how do we address it? We think that our Import Safety Action Plan helps us there. Certainly the Food Protection Plan, in focusing on prevention, helps us there so that we can implement some of those prevention elements in other countries or beyond our borders. Mike mentioned another problem and a challenge with coordination of our food responsibility. What may not be clear externally is that David Acheson, who some of you write about as the food czar, is the associate commissioner for foods within the agency. And much of what he does is help coordinate between the experts in CIFSAN, CVM, and ORA, and really provide that leadership and that information directly to the commissioner, as well as to folks at the Department of Health and Human Services, to know what it is that we're doing. Are we building and leveraging the expertise that's in those different centers within the agency? Frankly, I think the agency would agree with Mike's observation that some of our statutes are obsolete. That's why we asked for 10 new legislative authorities. You know, we've gone to Congress and said we need authorities in these 10 areas and need to do things differently. Despite kind of all the discussion about wanting to help the agency, I think there's been a lot of discussion about those, and we certainly hope that we'll see some of those come to fruition. The agency is on a trajectory, and if I could say where we're focusing in three areas that we think need to continue with the president's budget request and where we need to take things. The first one, I think that I'll have Mike give me a dollar later, except that would violate the guidelines. But the first area of those three is food protection. And that when we say, when the agency is talking about where does that investment go, food protection is absolutely, that's of the three, we start there. And looking at that preventive approach, if it's agreements with China, or looking more at how we approach the corporate responsibility of industry, because our regulatory approach is not only in food and drug regulation, but I'd argue in most of this society's regulation, that we as the regulator set the parameters, but we rely on corporate responsibility and industry to comply with those. And then when there's failure to comply, we come in on the other side. I think it's worth some healthy debate about what's the appropriate approach there. Is it a guidance? Is it a regulation? Is it something else? And what's appropriate for the circumstances? The second area really is medical product safety. Using the new authorities we have under the FDA Amendments Act, or FDAAA, how are we going to use those, and how can we improve what happens in medical product safety? How can we improve our risk communication? How can we help consumers understand that an early communication, which is what we put out on the suicidality concerns this week or the increased risk of cancer, is different from a public health advisory saying, please, you know, do not use these over-the-counter cough and cold medications in children under the age of 2, that we are at a different place in our regulatory process and are communicating something different. We don't have a good answer there, and I'm really looking to our Risk Communication Advisory Committee as well as a number of other efforts to help us improve that. The third piece is modernizing our workforce and our information technology, to saying that we invest in our people. The commissioner frequently states what is very true in the agency, and that's that our most valuable asset is our people. But for that to continue to be true, we need to continually be bringing in new individuals as well as investing in the folks who are already at the agency. And through some ideas of a fellowship program and other things, I think that will help us improve. As a final piece, Jill had asked me to address a little bit about the agency's interaction with Capitol Hill. And I think it's important to explain that the agency truly appreciates the input and the improvement that's yielded from our interaction with the Hill, the results of oversight and investigations. The Office of Legislation within FDA is part of my responsibility, and that staff works very hard to help individual agency employees understand that, you know, the congressional intent is to say, let's look at this, and then what fixes need to be put in place. Is it a new statute? Is it something else? Is it changing how the agency does things? And we work really hard to help staff understand that this really is intended to improve what we do and not intended to be intimidation. That's a challenging job when the request has come for all of the email communications from a certain employee, that all of their emails would be turned over to the committee. We provide that information, you know, as appropriate, and we respond. I think the challenge we have here is that we work with Congress, and we want to work with Congress, and we take their oversight role very seriously and collaborate. There is a cost to that collaboration and compliance. If I could just give you a snapshot, in the last 15 months, FDA has testified at 33 congressional hearings. If I were speaking here at the end of April, that number would be 37. So there would be 4 congressional hearings in April. Those are important for us because they allow us to explain what's happening on certain issues, but they do take time to prepare for and to have folks focus on that. If we look at the interaction we have on document requests or requests for briefings from one subcommittee as of March 7th, so looking all of 2007 to early March, we've had 91 requests for documents or briefings or a response on something. We have not responded to all 91 of those, but we've generated 128 responses to those 91 because we respond as soon as we can. Sometimes the information comes in on a rolling basis. If we combine that committee with some others, we have had 160 requests and 219 responses. I put those numbers out there to say that it's just a reality that if the question is about a foodborne outbreak or a specific product, and what we need to gather is information from an individual reviewer's or an individual inspector's files, there are only 60 minutes in an hour and 8 to 10 to 12 hours in a workday. And that some of that time, that spent looking for responsive emails or collecting responsive documents means that that individual is not working on that foodborne outbreak, or is not working on evaluating a safety signal for a medical product, or is not reviewing an application for a new medical product. It's just a reality. And we have to factor that into the reality. The commissioner has designated a specific person within my office who focuses on oversight and interaction, and we do the best that we can. So I guess, Jill, to answer your question about how we interact with the Hill, my one-word answer would be frequently. And I think respectfully, and that we are trying to improve things, it's just a reality of working at the agency today that there is a lot of work with the press, a lot of work with Congress, but the reason that we all come to work every day is to make sure that we are doing the best for the American public and see, you know, however that plays out and what we can do.
Okay. I think we want to... raised a lot of interesting points here, and we want to open it up to everybody here, and maybe I can go around with this microphone. But I think the take-home message is FDA has a lot to do. It's got great people working for it. They're all working really hard. It's overburdened and maybe needs some more legislative and regulatory help. But maybe the panel can start off by, I mean, Mike, why would FDA have to go to HHS to start a rulemaking? That doesn't make any sense. Oh, this is not on? So I've just been barred with Gavin. Hello?
The question was, why would FDA have to go to HHS to start a rulemaking in the first place? You'd think FDA could initiate rulemaking on its own. This is another bipartisan phenomenon over the last, you know, couple of decades of gradual and really, I think, pretty severe centralization of decision making about rulemaking in the government. And it's a White House driven thing. It's the Office of Management and Budget, the Office of Information and Regulatory Affairs in particular, which under various executive orders, you know, has very tight control over rulemaking. And so. And so as the step you go through before you even get to OMB is you have to go through, you know, the Secretary's office on any significant rulemaking. In an ideal world, I think Congress should empower FDA to initiate rulemaking independently. You know, I understand and value the importance of White House and political accountability for agencies, and so I'm not suggesting that FDA should somehow be freed from executive branch oversight, but there's a cumbersomeness to the process that is really stifling of the agency's ability to exert leadership and do the things that again, there can be strong consensus even within the industry community, as well as public health and public interest community, that something needs to be done, but the system itself bogs down in a very negative way, in my view.
Hi, I'm Melinda Hemmelgar, and I'm based in Columbia, Missouri. I'm both a registered dietitian and a journalist, so I appreciate your mention of food safety with healthcare. I've been working on so many issues that the FDA has recently touched on, you know, the E. coli and the spinach, which, you know, trying to get to the real truth of that with cattle ranches and the fecal matter was interesting. But I wonder if you could address two things. One, the accusation that FDA has this revolving door with industry. And also, I think that consumers generally, at least my sense is, that we have this idea of right to know. And there is a big push to label genetically modified foods. And I wonder if you could address some of the issues around the genetically modified food issue, and if consumers will finally see labels declaring those ingredients.
Yeah, two good questions. On the revolving door issue, you know, I'm exactly the right person to ask because I'm a veteran of the revolving door, and so naturally I don't think it's a big problem. And I think actually if you look at FDA and look at the people running the food function at FDA, there's not a real phenomenon there anyway. Even if you thought it was a bad thing that people would come from industry and then work in the regulatory agency, it doesn't happen that much at CIFSAN. Right. No, absolutely. And I'm very intimately familiar with that episode. And And again, I think there are a lot of rules about that, and care has to be taken, and I think FDA's credibility on that front is essential. And so, you know, I don't dismiss the importance of the issue and being managed right. I'm just saying in the context of today's food safety situation at the CFSAN and other parts of FDA, it's really not just factually a phenomenon that's very prevalent. So you can look into that, but that's my take on it.
And
so
again, if I could jump in just on that one, and then we can move to the second question. I guess I'd ask if any of you were recruiting someone to work for you, you would look for someone with skills and experience in the area where you're involved. So we look to people who have experience in food and medical product regulation. Sometimes those folks are in industry. Sometimes those folks are in professional society. Sometimes they're in academia. It's a mix. But part of this is if we say that no one from regulated industry should ever come work at the agency, we would be cutting ourselves off from people with very helpful expertise, as well as when those folks leave FDA and go out into the private sector, it's very helpful to have folks like Mike and others who understand kind of how it works and then can help us improve. So some may say revolving door, and they say it negatively. I'd say, are we getting people and help and who have good experience and good expertise, as well as then they take that experience and expertise into the private sector?
If you want to pursue that revolving door issue in the food arena, you'd be fruitful to look at USDA, where there's a long, I mean, that there's a big institutional conflict of interest in the food regulatory program there, because that department is all about looking after the interests of the ag sector, and so there's a long history of people from the National Cattlemen's Beef Association coming into to senior positions. I just tell this funny little story. When I went to be administrator of FSIS, and went into my office for the first time and saw the telephone and the speed dial. There were like two speed dial things there. One of them was to the National Cattlemen's Beef Association, which I found to be remarkable coming from FDA land, where again, I think FDA, it's a fair question to ask, but I think that's the least of FDA's problems right now. I mean, I just think that in any event. So on the issue of labeling, I mean, I think, you know, that's a really good question, where I think FDA is in a tough spot because it's implementing statutes that are not right to know statutes per se, and so it's got, you know, definitions of misbranding which control when it can mandate disclosure of a process that was used to produce a product. And FDA has felt that it, for precedent reasons, it didn't want to go out to the point of, you know, mandating disclosure of a process. I think, frankly, there is room within FDA's laws to be a little more creative about that. And I personally think that that good public policy, whether FDA is empowered to do it under its current laws or not, you know, ought to respond to, in various contexts, to people's interest in knowing something about the process. It comes a point where it's a matter of sufficient broad enough interest that it becomes part of the identity of the product, in my view. So whether it's GM, you know, crops, or it's cloned, you know, product from cloned animals, I mean, I think this resistance to transparency about what you're trying to sell people and expecting them to eat is a real mistake strategically for the industry. And I think, again, FDA, be nice if it was more empowered to do some, you know, different kinds of public policy approaches on that.
I guess two questions.
You're looking like I didn't answer your question.
Well, I think, were you also thinking about addressing the GMO
labeling? Actually, Mike got it right. On the assessment of the statute, I'm not to his opinion. I think that the challenge, we don't have that legislative proposal currently before Congress, that what we do now is we label what we can under our statutes. And I think it's very fair and certainly an area for discussion and where we'd like to have more input. You know, our challenge is there a material difference related to safety? Then it's labeled.
Gardner Harris from the New York Times. Two things. One, I think that would be interesting to all of us, and that is that all of us have basically had to abandon FOIA at FDA. Your FOIA function is so bad. It's so, when we do a FOIA, it may be that we will get it in 2010, maybe 2011. That is obviously not a useful function. Can you talk to us about what has happened there. I understand there's been some search that journalists are only something like 6 or 7 or 8% of the FOIA requests. This may be an issue of resources. Please ask for them. And then, Mike, one question for you. Having been at FSIS and at FDA, there's some talk, Rosa DeLauro talks about maybe making a food agency that would combine the functions of something like 13 different federal agencies. What do you think of that, having been at both?
Yeah.
I was trying to come up with the best visual for FOIA requests. And let's say there's a pipeline that the requests come into, and we have staff who address them, but then they have to go out to reviewer staff to get the answers to then have the results come out at the end. The challenge with that pipeline is that the universe of FOIA requests here is actually probably about as big as that screen. And so the pipeline and the capacity that we have to address those requests far exceeds the capacity of our pipeline to then put something out at the end. And it's, I think the other, well, it is, but then if you're the management decision faced with do we have more people so that they can respond to the FOIA requests more quickly, frankly, the first place I'd put their efforts are in food safety and medical product safety before FOIA. And I regret that that would be my recommendation, but at the end of the day, that's the first mandate. So there is also some thought of how we can improve the processes and if there's a way to expand that pipeline. But it's fair to say that I doubt that the first commitment of resources would be to expanding FOIA. Now, I think we can explore ways to improve it or prioritize and do some other pieces, but it's not going to be the investment of the first dollar.
Yeah, I mean, short answer is I think that is the right ultimate place to go and be in terms of having the capacity to have a national food safety program that makes good use of all the collective resources and that can work at state and local levels and work globally, you know, to have a truly effective preventive food safety system. Congresswoman DeLauro, Senator Durbin have introduced legislation in this Congress and the previous Congress that would do that. I would emphasize that it just putting organizations together without modernizing the statutory mandates, I wouldn't support. I don't think it would be worth the effort and the disruption if you aren't also particularly modernizing the USDA inspection mandate. This century-old idea that it's a good use of federal food safety resources to visually examine 125 million head of livestock and 9 billion chickens for a couple of seconds, has been discredited by the National Academy of Sciences, by the General Government Accountability Office. There's $1 billion of the $1.5 billion or so total federal food safety resource, about $1 billion is going into an obsolete USDA inspection program. And so really what we need to do is modernize the mandate so they get the charge to use their resources in a risk-based way. And you still have a lot of inspectors in slaughter plants. That, believe me, having been in there, that's a critical part of the food safety system, but you wouldn't have them doing what they're doing today. So, yeah, I think we've got to modernize the mandate and unify the agencies and create a point of accountability and leadership in the federal system for food safety. I would also say, though, that in terms of urgency of problem to be solved and likelihood for sequence of events, I think it is the right thing to do to focus, as Congress is now, focus initially on fixing FDA and fixing the FDA food program in terms of modernizing the mandate, unifying and elevating the institutional pieces within FDA and create essentially a model food safety agency within HHS, and then in due course transition the meat and poultry elements of the food supply into that modern agency, whether it stays within HHS or becomes independent. You know, I don't have really strong feelings. I mean, the fact is that the FDA function within HHS is kind of a stepchild function. It is so different from 95% of what goes on at HHS, and 95% of management attention goes legitimately, you could argue, to the healthcare, finance, and other, you know, kinds of issues that you're very familiar with. But as between USDA and HHS, you definitely want the food safety program in the health, you know, health part of the government, not the agriculture part of the government. It would unify the agencies and create a separate agency along the model of the EPA, still part of the executive branch, not an independent regulatory agency like FTC, but independent, separate from HHS and USDA.
Yeah, I'm Laura Beal, freelance writer. I have a question about off-label use. In pediatrics, two-thirds of the drugs that are commonly used in children have not been tested in children, and in some specialties, it's like oncology, it's 80 to 90%. What's the FDA doing to try to encourage industry to get pediatric labeling?
That's actually a piece that I think is a very good success story as well as a future success story, that within our Office of Pediatrics, in looking at what's happening in pediatric clinical trials and gathering more information, that office does a very good job of working with the centers and saying, what information do we have here? Congress has provided some incentives where that work is done and then yields new information and new indications. There is even some more work in FDAAA to help strengthen what happens there. The good news is that I think, in contrast to 10, 15 years ago, there's an instant recognition that the pediatric population are not just little adults, and so we can just use a smaller dose, and that we need to better understand what it means to implant a medical device in a three-month-old when that device really should be, you know, maybe with that child for their life, which now can be in the, you know, the 70-plus years. And what does that mean long-term if they will need other devices and how those things are adapted? That is a piece where the agency has invested the time and with the support of Congress and regulated industry to say, what can we do to address that? So there is work being done, but recognize there were a whole lot of medical products approved prior to this investment. And so there's a wealth of things that are already out there, and we try to improve that research, but it's certainly under attention now, and addressing some of that backlog will come in the future.
Yeah, I'm Carl Stark from the Philadelphia Inquirer. I had two questions. One, I'd like to reiterate what was said about FOIA and access to FDA in general, that you talk a lot about wanting to interact with the press and get your word out to the public, but it's very difficult to get any kind of systematic response, both FOIA and in other ways. The association just did a survey of journalists who use FOIA in the FDA, and I don't want to scoop their thunder. They're going to release it later today. But, you know, a colleague of mine who sits near me, you know, got an FDA FOIA response back last week, and it was first filed in, like, late 2005. And even though, you know, when you say that you make a choice, you say, well, it's either inspectors or FOIA, really that's a false choice, because you have a statutory requirement to respond to FOIA. You have a statutory requirement to do inspections. You can't pick and choose which ones you're going to follow. You've got to follow the law.
Well, although I'd say we follow the law, but I haven't yet figured out how to get more than 24 hours in a day. So I hear you. And say that we do want to improve the FOIA response, but there are statutory requirements, and then there's reality.
Yeah, I would just like to say that on our committee, Peter Barton Hutt, the former chief counsel for FDA, took it upon himself to actually do a historical review of the agency, trying to get at roles and responsibilities and resources. And in the last 15 years, there have been over 120 of these statutes that have been imposed upon the agency. That's about 6 per year, and that doesn't include the many that came with PDUFA legislation in the fall of this year. But in fact, none of them came with increased funding, and therein lies the problem.
I agree
with the two people that have said that I think that access by way of FOIA is extremely important, but obviously does take time to produce and respond to those requests. And I'm not sure, but what my answer would be the same, Susan, in terms of orders of priority when you look at where the real problems are. If you look at adverse event reporting in general, there's been a many-fold increase in those, and yet the same number of personnel over the last few years assigned to reviewing those adverse event reports. So do you choose to not put your effort there versus, you know, a FOIA request? I think all of our answers would probably be the same.
And to your point about getting access to subject matter experts, as I mentioned, FDA's Office of Public Affairs is in part of my management responsibility, and we have put in a lot of systems to try and improve access and get the media to those subject matter experts. I hear frequently from reporters, from Hill staff, from GAO staff, if we could just go straight to the FDA, or I know I'd get an answer faster. I would caution you that I'm not certain that's true, because what we try to do in the press shop, in our Office of Exec Sec, and in our Office of Legislation is help get those questions to the people and then push on them to get a response for you. And so there is a dynamic that we help facilitate that, but I would observe that at the end of the day, you're really better off working with us and seeing what we can do to get to those subject matter experts. And in many cases, we get you there, and we're always working on ways to get you there more quickly.
Okay, so here's a real live example. Maybe you can show how you would react in real time. A fish coming into this country from other countries, what databases does the FDA have to measure what's coming in, and what do they show in terms of what are the leading countries of you know that are importing the most fish? You know, what can you give me a sense of what data is available and just a sense of what that data might show?
In how we would respond to that request is saying, okay, do you want to know what's the time period of your request? Do you want to say on March 17th what fish was coming into the country, and maybe it's running that type of a report? Is it saying on March 17th what companies said they were going to ship fish into the United States, but then you want to know what countries or what companies, rather, we had an import alert, so that's where the fish is actually stopped at the border? I happen to have just printed out an aquaculture or seafood import alert yesterday, and it was 99 pages long with all of the companies and the countries, rather, and then all the companies that are affected. But there's the good news is the inspector doesn't have to look at that 99-page report. Rather, it's built into some of the systems. But that question that you may perceive as being very simple and direct probably requires the involvement of a number of different people from the field force, from the center, the product center with the expertise, and then trying to match up what data we have and could provide you and the question that you've asked. So what in my work with our public affairs staff is trying to work with you and say, we may not be able to answer question X, but we could give you this data set that gives you a slightly different answer. But it's challenging, and well, yeah, I had no idea of the myriad of databases of folks involved in what we try to navigate.
I get okay. Mr. Taylor, could you take a crack at that, or what databases exist and what the situation shows?
Actually giving you the answer? No, if I were you, I would ask to sit down and be able to interview the expert at the agency who does know the answer to that. I mean, whether that's part of the system, but the filter, if there's a filtering process through public affairs, I think that I can see why that begins to be a little bit frustrating.
Well, I think it's pretty clear that if FDA feels that the press is not responding to what they're telling the press, there's obviously a lot of frustration at the other end. And maybe that's something that there should be further dialogue about and some further examination about what FDA can do to actually respond to these requests for information. I know it used to be 10 years ago, yeah, you could call somebody at FDA up on the phone and they respond to you. The reason why you don't get information from them now, they're all scared. They won't talk to you.
Well, it is. I think, as I said, the role of the Office of Public Affairs is to get you an answer. And what we're finding is that it's a better response through us than not with our help. And that's, we try to be a facilitator. I tell you, I probably get most of my emails between the hours of 6 p.m. and 2 a.m. are press when we're debating about things, and I obviously don't see all of them. I see only very specific ones where there might be a challenge. But the volume is significant. I wish I had the statistics here of the number of folks about different issues asking specific questions and the responses that are provided. It is a significant volume, but it's in that competing dynamic of Janet Woodcock having 24 hours in a day, and where do we focus that response? And so do we try to do media telecons? Do we try to post information on the web? Do we do media availability where we can? I hear your frustration, and it's something that we similarly have tried to address.
Susan, we were told during our review that there were 7 people in the communications office total. Can you clarify that?
Yeah, that's not
how many are there?
Yeah, that's not my count.
I understand, but how many are there in order to be able to respond to these requests?
The Office of Public Affairs, it's definitely over 7.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the number that I have in my head is the total of the 4 offices that I supervise, which is Ledge, ExecSec, Legislation, ExecSec, External Relations, and Public Affairs, which is press, is about 100.
What about public affairs, though, that would be interacting with press? How many are there?
What I'm saying is that I know the 100 figure, but it's probably in the 25 to 30 range.
Mm-hmm. Let me just, if I may, just a brief sort of philosophical observation with this question you're asking. I mean, there are a couple of things you should know about FDA and its situation in terms of transparency and access to information. I mean, one is that there's a traditional culture, kind of a professional science culture within FDA that says, you know, our job is to do our job and to do the science and to make decisions and do all of that. And I think there's a lot of validity to that. In the day age in which we work, though, I guess I would argue that philosophically FDA needs to sort of rethink its stance in terms of its relation to the world and how it explains itself, how it justifies itself. And how it builds the constituent support for the budget that it needs. I mean, part of FDA's problem with its budget is that it doesn't have, until very recently, activated external constituencies that have advocated for it. And I think part of what they need to do is sort of develop a new way of communicating and engaging. There's also, and I don't know whether Susan wants to comment on this, but I mean, at least early in this administration, there was a centralization of control over press. And from the outside, where I sit just as an academic stakeholder, you know, a sense that there was a tightening down of access to expert, you know, staff, you know, to the press. And I think, you know, that's part of the philosophical rethink that I think is justified, is how do you give FDA the ability to have a really affirmative strategy for making itself transparent and accessible and able to explain itself to the world.
And there is a process for access. The only thing I'd add is I have done a fair amount of media training for pharmacists and physicians in my prior life in helping them understand that interacting with the media and with reporters, with journalists, is very much so to the advantage of the individual, to the cause, to what it is that you want to do. But the challenge that we face, as Mike mentioned, is kind of this the scientific approach and at least trepidation. You know, the same scientist who will stand up in front of a room of 2,000 people and explain the intricacies of drug-eluting stents would no more come and sit at this panel than put their foot in a bear trap. And I know, and I would spend a lot of time convincing them that, in fact, they should come here because it's a very good interaction. But no, there's a hesitation, there's a concern, there's a nervousness, there's trepidation. And part of what we try to do from the communications in the press shop is help them understand that this really is a win-win and that we do want to have access and do need to work with the media to advance and really meet our mission, but it's a tension.
This has an air of unreality to me. Going back to the George Bush 1 administration, these kinds of controls didn't exist. We got through the Cold War without these kinds of controls. We did very well. This press office rule is about controlling us. It's not about helping us. You've cut the agencies that have done this have cut down on communication by about 90%. And we in the trade press are the ones that feel it the most. We can't get through. That's a myth. We can't get through.
Well, and then perhaps we just have a philosophical disagreement because
it's
the mandate.
Well,
it's a statistical disagreement that my mandate to the press office as well as from the commissioner is to be a facilitator. But the stuff that's coming into the pipeline again exceeds what we can possibly get out. So we do our best. I will tell you that I hear the same thing from FDA staff who say, how many press inquiries are you going to send me? No, I don't have time to do this. And it's trying to say to you, can we get you to the subject matter experts at the same time that the subject matter expert says, I've got to come to resolution on this safety signal or where we are with salmonella today and what else has to happen. So I hear you. I am disappointed that there's an air of or a lack of reality, but that is the direction that I've provided, and I know when that press shop comes in, and you'll hear from Julie Zavisha tomorrow, who runs that shop and does a very good job of trying to make sure that we get through. Let's talk about solutions rather than continuing to say, no, you're wrong, they really don't help. That doesn't fix the challenge that we face. What can we do? Can we think creatively about how to improve access and get more information? One of the things we've talked about is a weekly press call, and just on a myriad issues with specific things. But I know that's not, incites some eye rolling over here, because you want your question asked to you. And then your competitors don't have the answer to it, well, I've got to look at how do I make the resources available, and if it's putting the right people on the phone and they answer the questions to everyone, that may be a 30-minute press call that answers a whole lot of questions that otherwise would have taken 8 hours, or maybe we wouldn't even get to your answers.
Well, if FDA got more resources, maybe it would solve some of these problems for you, but it sounds like it's a much bigger issue than that and something we can't resolved right now. There will be another panel tomorrow that maybe you can take some of these issues to. But I want to thank the panel for presenting some interesting viewpoints and ideas. And we're running over, so we're going to have to cut this off. We've got an important lunch meeting, I think, just right down the hall. And thank you all for coming.
Feed the meter.
Yeah, I should probably feed the meter. Well, thank you. You're